Blog Talk Radio.
This episode of HR Happy Hour is sponsored by Acquire, makers of Insight, the workforce planning and analytics solution that takes the work out of workforce analytics. That's right, that thing you dread having to do? Well, Insight makes it easy. Check out the live Twitter stream via the hashtag #HRHappyHour right now for a link to a video demo of Insight.
Welcome to the HR Happy Hour show.
You didn't let that go very long at all.
I know. There's a whole sort of talking part. We'll play that. We'll play that again at the end of the show. It's a fun
okay.
song. You know the song, right, Shauna?
I don't.
Oh, we'll play it at the end of the show. It's about robots and that sort of thing. So, welcome to the HR Happy Hour show. We are so happy to be back with you. This is the HR Happy Hour. This is episode 87. Called Robots and Social Networks. If you're listening to this sometime in the distant future, perhaps,
ooh.
It's being originally recorded and broadcast on February 17th, 2011. I am Steve Bowes, your humble servant for the next 60 minutes.
Aww.
Quite humble. With me, of course, Shauna Morkey, the HR Minion. How are you, Shauna?
I'm doing really well. Super excited and ready to geek out over this show.
Yeah, I am really excited about the show. Some quick announcements.
You're really geeking out.
I am. I'm totally geeked up on the show tonight. Our call-in number, you know, here it is. Write it down. Remember it. 646-378-1086. If you want to come on board and get into the mix tonight, call in and press 1. We'll try to get you on board later in the show. If you're on Twitter tonight, on the back channel, of course, our hashtag #HRHappyHour as well. And Shauna will be monitoring that, sort of like the hall monitor, you know, keeping things in line and making sure
for
the shenanigans. Right, exactly.
I'm all about the shenanigans, Steve. You know that.
You ought to be able to put someone in, like, Twitter detention if they get too out of hand. You ought to be able to do
Dude.
That.
Dude! I want to do that.
Great. Well, super. So let's just get right to it. We are really excited about tonight's show on robots and social networks. And it was kind of a coincidence that the scheduling of this show happened to be the same week of the IBM computer Watson playing on Jeopardy, right? So there's been a lot of robot talk this week in the popular press and online. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And Watson did dominate the competition, in case you missed it. But, you know, talking robots and social networks tonight, how they actually, the concepts sort of connect, and really some of the important questions that are raised by our relationship with robots, part one, and then sort of the connected life in the socially networked world, part two. So we have a fantastic guest who's going to come on and join us. It's Professor Sherry Turkle. And let me just read a little bit of her bio. Professor Turkle is the Abby Rockefeller Mausoleum. That's a complicated title. Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. That's big time. And the founder and director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. She's also, this is good for me, really, maybe after the show, she's also a licensed clinical psychologist, which I think we all might need a little help from. And she's also the author of, yeah, exactly. She's the author of books called The Second Self, Life on the Screen, and her most recent book that we'll be talking about tonight is called Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Let's please welcome Professor Sherry Turkle to the show. Sherry, welcome to the show tonight.
My pleasure to be here.
It's so great to have you. How did I do on the bio? Did I get through it okay?
Everything, including the French accent. I'm odd.
I like that.
Ooh.
You know, that's the one thing, those accents. I think I know how to say them, but I don't know how to type them, right? Like those secret commands on the keyboard to make the little accent, the
right.
the ague and all those things.
Right.
So
I know the one for the aigu. I don't know the one for the grave. So
grave. I don't even know what they even which even one is anymore. I just like to say the words. I like the word aigu, and I like the word grave too. But I don't know. I don't know what either of them mean. So, but it's so great to have you, Professor, on the show tonight. Could you maybe just tell us a little bit more beyond that extensive bio I read? A little bit more about your background and sort of what brought you to the place where you decided to study. The robots, the sociable robots, and so what led you to write Alone Together?
Well, I've been studying computers and people really ever since I got to MIT in the late 70s, early 80s. And my first book, The Second Self, Alone Together is the third in a trilogy about computers and people. The first book, The Second Self, was really about the one-on-one of people and machines. And I called it The Second Self because a 13-year-old girl who had a personal computer and was programming it. After all, I wrote it in 1984, so I was studying those early personal computers that people actually programmed. And this little 13-year-old who had been learning Logo at school said, when you program a computer, you take a little piece of your mind and you put it into the computer's mind and you come to see yourself differently. And so I called the book The Second Self because to me that captured really what a computer is. It's kind of projection of you onto the machine. And then my second book, Life on the Screen, which came out in 1995, was about the early social networks. I mean, the early AOL, you know, going, using the computer as a portal to being with each other in new virtual realities. And it was about experimentation with identity. One of my students, Amy Bruckman, used the word identity workshops to talk about how we experiment with self online and how the world of online relationships really offer us a whole new kind of way to do that. And I was very excited by that as a psychologist, and Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of the Internet, was a book about that. And it was a very optimistic book because all my psychologist friends were saying, oh, this is fantasy, this is dangerous. I really saw the possibilities for, you know, a kind of new adventure for people to experiment with aspects of themselves. And so I finished that book in 1995, and I came back to MIT, and I saw two things that really took my breath away and that I hadn't foreseen when I wrote Life on the Screen. And the first one was sociable robots, and I met a robot called Cog, and this is a robot that Rodney Brooks had developed in the AI lab that basically looks you in the eye, gestures towards you, and tracks your motion. And when I met this robot in Rodney Brooks' lab, a great roboticist at MIT, I realized that I was kind of competing for its attention, and I wanted it to recognize me, and I was there with Chris Langton, who was a great figure in the history of artificial life, and I wanted it to recognize me more than Christopher Langton.
Right, right.
And I was like, you know, jealous if it paid attention to Christopher Langton, even though I knew that Cog didn't like know from anything. And I realized that this was a kind of robot that pushed our buttons to believe that there was kind of somebody home, something sentient, something caring, even if we know that there's nobody home, nothing
right.
Sentient, nothing caring. And I determined that I was going to tell the story as those robots developed and kind of were rolled out as consumer products, and now they're being offered, particularly in Japan, now coming to this country as kind of elder care bots and nanny bots and really as artificial companions. And then the second thing that I hadn't seen, and I tell my students, you know, call me not prescient. I mean, I hadn't seen it.
I was thinking a second ago, Sherry, like when you were writing the first book, did you say to yourself, man, everything is changing. This is incredibly remarkable. And, you know, I should start a site called Facebook, you know, and to take advantage of it. Like, I mean, because you were
didn't
right
you say
there.
That to me, girls, though?
Well, no, but I'm saying that I didn't see something. I didn't see something when I wrote Life on the Screen that I saw in 1995 and that I just determined to follow. I mean, I'm not so much an entrepreneur as I really am a social scientist. I mean, I'm really interested in how it develops and in tracing the psychology of how it develops. I'm not, I didn't say I can make a buck on this.
Right.
I had imagined that this identity play would sort of take place in defined periods of time when you were at your computer.
Right.
And in 1995, I met that group at MIT called the Cyborgs. Steve Mann was in it. Thad Starner was in it. They kind of wore their computers on their backs, and they had keyboards in their pockets, and they wore glasses that were their screens. And I realized that I hadn't taken into account that people were going to be able to play with these other identities and be on the web and kind of bail out from where they were in the physical world and with the people around them, essentially whenever they wanted. That mobile connectivity was going to give us this alternate reality all the time, because technology was going to be with us all the time. And that completely changes the terms of the psychological terms of the game.
Right.
And that's how I came to write the book.
I'm sorry, Sherry, but when you tell the story in the book about the cyborgs, at least initially they must have seemed kind of unusual, kind of strange. I can imagine them walking around the campus and people kind of giving them sideways glances, like, what
people
are these strange
characters?
People thought they were
disabled. Right. People thought they were disabled. People would be offering them drinks and food and chairs and, you know, really, or shunning them because they looked as though they, you know, some people shun the disabled. But when I saw them, I realized that this was the future, that we were going to have technology that was always on us, and that we were going to be always on the web, and that was going to completely change the psychological aspect of what this identity play meant. Because it's one thing to come home after the end of a day of being, you know, with the people around you physically and play with an online identity. It's a completely other thing to be constantly interrupted in your physical life by your, you know, by tweeting and Facebook and your, you know, and by kind of, you know, the way I put it is I sit in a park all day doing my field work and people are pushing their kids on the swing with one hand and checking their email and going onto Facebook and going onto Second Life.
Right.
With
right.
The
I've done that too. Right, because you've got to make that. And I'm going to tell you what, Shauna, people out there listening to the show have done it too. You know you've pushed swing, and with the other hand, you're tweeting, hey, I'm at the park pushing on the swing. It's fantastic day.
Or you're checking into Foursquare, or you're checking out your Twitter friends. Oh, yeah, totally.
Right.
Becoming the mayor of the sandbox. Exactly.
Right.
I feel like my phone is
attached to my hands.
Yeah, but, you know, I study those kids, and, you know, I'm not saying that a little bit of this, I mean, I'm not an alarmist. I mean, I'm not saying that, look, you know, you're in the park and you want to tweet something or something occurs to you or you want to check what a friend is doing that, you know, I'm not saying it's the end of the world. But I interview those kids. I interview 350 kids about sort of their relationship to connectivity and sort of how their life was in their families. And those kids are lonely. Those kids miss their parents because their parents are not paying attention to them when they're on the jungle gym and they look down. They can't get their dad's attention when they're trying to show off.
Sherry, I want to circle back to that in a minute because that's sort of the next line of questioning I wanted to bring up. But I do want to do a quick reset. We're 15 minutes into the show already. This is the HR Happy Hour. Our guest is Professor Sherry Turkle of MIT. She's the author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, which is available, you know, everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think if you hurry really quickly, you might find a Borders still open where you can buy one.
I'm sad about Borders.
I know, I am too. That's where I bought my copy, out of Borders. That was open.
Oh, I got mine on my Kindle. my netbook with Kindle.
Yeah, I want to be more connected with the real world, Shauna. I still buy regular, real paper books.
Dude, I have like 600 books in my bedroom. Don't even start with me.
That is just me. So Professor Sherry Turkle is with us. She's on Twitter as well. Not at the moment, I don't think, but her Twitter handle is sturkle, sturkle as well. And Professor, when you get back on Twitter, you probably will see a flood of mentions of your name during the course of this show.
That's
so
great.
Be prepared for those.
It's a misperception that I'm telling people to log off, get off Twitter. I'm not. I'm saying that people know. People have a sense if their online life is interfering with the rest of their life. And that's what I'm asking people to attend to.
Right.
You know, is your family texting during dinner? It's a simple question. If you're sitting with your kids and you're all texting during dinner, I'm saying that's not good.
Right, right.
And I don't want that to be interpreted as Sherry Turkle says unplug. That's not fair to the situation that we find ourselves in. It's simply not fair to the situation we find ourselves in. It doesn't do it justice.
Sherry, you brought up children, and we talked about, you know, sort of kiddingly in a way, the pushing on the swing with the BlackBerry, but you've done extensive studies of children and their relationships with robots in particular, and there's quite a bit of content in the book about that. I just thought maybe you could talk a little bit about your observations and maybe some of the conclusions you drew from, you know, putting robots, like even the primitive sort of Tamagotchis and the Furbies, into the hands of children. And, yeah, that, you know, the right?
I remember that.
And sort of what you observed and what you kind of took from those early studies of these sort of kind of primitive robots and how children reacted to them.
Well, it turns out that we are just the way I wanted Cog's attention when it did the simplest things like, you know, look me in the eye and track my motion. And I found myself wanting its attention, being drawn to it that way. You know, it turns out that we're kind of cheap dates. We're very vulnerable to a robot doing things like that because those robots push our Darwinian buttons. That the last thing we saw in our evolution that did those things were people. And it turns out that the thing that is the most seductive and the simplest Tamagotchi does it, and the simplest robot, like a Furby or a My Real Baby, does it, is ask for nurturance. A Tamagotchi asks you to love it. A Tamagotchi asks you to take care of it, to feed it, to amuse it. And as soon, it's like nurturance is the killer app. As soon as a robot asks for attention and love, we bond to it. That's the nature of us as human animals. And that's a very dangerous thing because that's a vulnerability because we attach to things that in a way don't deserve our love because we nurture what we love, mm-hmm. but we also love what we nurture. And if a machine designer can get us to nurture something, it gets us to attach to it. And that means that we become very, you know, very vulnerable. And, you know, that's why now when robots are being marketed as companions for the elderly, you know, elder care bots, and then there are nanny bots and teachers bots, all of these, you know, coming out of Japan and very popular in Japan and starting to be marketed here, we're very vulnerable because, you know, when something asks for our attention and care, and we give it, we start to bond with it. And these things don't understand us. They're pretending to. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, why do we want to have an old woman try to explain the death of her child in Iraq or the death of her husband to a creature that doesn't understand or that's pretending to understand. And it's not like a pet. A pet isn't pretending anything. You know, these robots are pretending to understand what you're saying. It's quite a different enterprise. So
yeah.
I was concerned about that.
Yeah, and Sherry, in the book you talk a little bit about sort of the implications and really the threat, maybe threat's too strong a word, but the potential hazards of us embracing these kinds of robots more and more into things like elder care or child care, things like that. Right before the show, Sherry, our friend Watson that we talked about, right, the human manipulating Watson, sent out an article about Watson getting involved in medical care. And on the surface, it talked more about, you know, having that repository of knowledge of diseases and case studies that, you know, more than any human could possibly have,
yeah,
right, in recall. But if you read really close, it gets into, there's a quote from one of the doctors involved in the study, and he talks about Watson sort of, you know, filling the role that his medical students and some of his residents play today, right?
Yes.
And he talks specifically, and this is what makes me think about some of the things in the book, Sherry. In the article,
yeah,
I read just before the show, the doctor, the research fellow, talks about, my medical students and residents, they grow up, they move on. But Watson will always be here, right? And that reminded me of some of the things in the book.
Where was this article?
It just came out today. We'll find the link and tweet it out again.
That's terrifying, because one of the things I found, it's really interesting that you should say that, is one of the things I found with people talking about robots is that things move from better than nothing to better than anything. And this is what I mean by that.
Okay.
A little girl will say, a robot puppy, that would be good. It's better than nothing. My father is allergic to dogs, so I can't have a dog. And then a couple of interviews later, she's saying, a robot puppy, well, that's kind of better than a dog because I can always stay a puppy, and it's great to always have a puppy. And then by the next interview, she's saying, a robot dog, that's better than any dog. It'll never die.
Right.
So it goes from better than nothing, I can't have a dog, he's allergic, to basically a robot being able to offer what no alive thing could ever offer. And this is sort of what you're describing, this slow slippage that's happening with this doctor talking about Watson.
Right,
you know, first,
right,
we'll put in a computer and it'll be good because it'll have all these diagnostic facts and it won't replace a doctor, but it'll just be for sort of intake. And then somehow, you know, three conversations later, well, my medical students really are interested in the people anyway. They're kind of young and inexperienced, and anyway, they want to move on and do something else, and this robot will always be there. Or this robot will never lose its patience. Or this robot will listen to people who are boring and repetitive, and it'll never be curt or coarse with them. And all of a sudden, a robot is better than a person could ever be. And that's something to really, really watch out for.
Right.
Really, really watch out for.
Let me just take a pause for a second, Sean. It's been fascinating stuff. You know,
very
Sean,
cool.
You're a really technologically savvy person as well, and I know how you appreciate some of this.
I talk about
our relationship with machines and with robots, and we'll sort of, I promise, you know, 180 a little bit into sort of the social network content, which I know is near and dear to the hearts of our listeners and our friends online as well. But just a quick reset. Yeah, of course.
I think the robot stuff is important because, you know, we have to be ready for it. It's not science fiction. It's coming, and it's good to have a conversation now.
Sherry, I see a lot of parallels.
I mean,
as we're talking on the show right now, I mean, my version of my robot overlords are calling to me too. My BlackBerry is a foot away, and the red light's blinking, and it's blinking and blinking and blinking. And as soon as the show's over, I have to pick it up, right? I have to. And it's how different is that? Isn't that sort of nurturing, right? It's calling for me to take care of it, to attend to it.
Absolutely. And it's also saying that it'll take care of you. It'll make you feel important. It'll make you feel, people talk about their BlackBerries and they say it's the place for hope in my life. It's the place for hope in my life.
Yeah.
That's a little far.
All right, let's do a quick reset. We're with Professor Sherry Turkle. We're talking about robots and social networks. Professor Turkle is the author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Absolutely. I'm not just saying this because, you know, Sherry's on the phone with me. And we're going to talk about why we don't like talking on the phone, too, in a second. Because when I was reading that part of the book, Sherry, I was like, oh, man, that is me. I do not want to be on the phone with anybody. But we're at HR Happy Hour, of course. Our call-in number, 646-378-1086. There's loads of people online. If you want to get on board and ask a question or make a comment, just press 1 on your handset, and we'll see your little flag waving, and we'll bring you on board. On Twitter as well, Shauna is keeping an eye on the Twitter stream. Lots of interesting conversation going on out there. I have been accused of being a robot myself, which
speaking out too much to be a robot. Robot technology has advanced to the point of being a fanboy on something, I think we're safe. I think Steve is so human.
I don't know. Professor, I want to ask you a quick question, though, about you know, I was really fascinated in the book about the stories about Cog and Kismet. I just wonder if you could comment a little bit about what sort of were the motivations for developing those robots. I mean, you're approaching your analysis of them and your observation from a sort of a psychological, psychoanalytical point of view, but was that why they were developed, or were they exercises in just building robots, you know, robot intelligence?
Well, actually, the idea of having a robot that could partner with people, I mean, for example, Cynthia Brazil, who did the Kismet work, a lot of her interest is if you were sending up, let's say, an astronaut into space and you needed to communicate with that, you wanted to have a robotic helper. It would not be efficient to be typing at each other. What would be most efficient would be for that robot to be able to read your facial expression, for that robot to be able to read you putting up your hand in that universal gesture that means stop.
Right.
And that is how we should be able to communicate through gesture and speech with robots. So those uses of robots that can understand human facial expression and gesture are designed for situations in which it's appropriate to have human helpers, robotic and machine helpers, you know, in situations like that. The question is not whether we should develop that scientific information, but to what purposes we then put it. So, you know, using that to have soldiers have machines work with them in Iraq to go in dangerous situations and have the robots protect the soldiers, I'm 100% for it.
Right.
Elder care bots, I call that love's labor lost. This is something that people deserve to be doing for people. Or even the earliest sociable robot dolls were billed as dolls that would help socialize your child. Only human beings should socialize a child. And there's every difference in the world. I mean, some of the reviews of my book have said, and it's kind of unfair, and I encourage your listeners to, you know, read the book. Because I discuss this, you know, not just kind of form an opinion kind of on a, you know, without listening to the, you know, to the argument. People say, but
right.
haven't we always had dolls? What's the big deal? Now we'll have robots.
Right. Right.
And it's all the difference in the world, because a doll leaves what I call a projective space. It's there and you can project your desires, your hopes, your aspirations onto it. If a little girl has just broken her mother's china, she puts her Barbie dolls in detention. You know, she does unto the robots what she thinks should be done unto her. Or in the Castaway, was it a
volleyball.
Wilson. Tom Hanks' character, you know, turns Wilson into his best friend. You know, that's how children use their imagination to turn the inanimate into what they need the inanimate to be. Now, that is very different than a robot that, when you're telling it the story of your life, deceives you into saying, yes, I understand that child's death. Yes, I understand your mother and your feelings. That's sucking the air out of your ability to project and get what you need and your fantasies and your hopes and dreams. And that's just pretense.
Right.
So, you know, this technology was designed for one purpose. And then people think, oh, you know, I bet we can use this for that giant market in elder care facilities. Let's make an argument why this would be a good thing. And I'm making an argument for why, or let's try to sell this to parents as a babysitter and convince parents that this will help them socialize their child. I bet there's a market there.
Yeah, there's probably a market. I can't see that ending up well. I just can't.
No, it's not going to end up well. But we're very vulnerable. That's really what I. My analysis is always in terms of human technological affordance and human vulnerability. We are very vulnerable to what this technology offers. And one of the things about technology is that it sometimes makes us forget everything we know about life. You know, and when you ask somebody, you know, really, would you want to be talking to somebody, to something that's just pretending to understand what you're saying?
Right. And Sherry, on that note, I want to pause. We're about halfway through the show, a little
sure.
bit more. I want to spin a little bit forward, right, and to cover some of the area that you tackle in the second part of Alone Together,
sure.
which is the networked world and sort of the always-on environment. So I want to kick off this sort of discussion thread. I'm going to read a quote straight out of the book, okay,
sure.
Sherry? This is on page 154. Okay.
I don't have my copy with me, but you have your copy. Good for you.
I do. I have it right here. but we talked about nurturance earlier in the show.
Yeah.
So here's what you say on page 154. Nurturance was the killer app for robotics. Networked life has a parallel. We tend to the net, and the net teaches us to need it. Right. So to me, that as I read the book and was trying to understand how we made the leap from the robots, the sociable robots, and our relationships with them to the net, to me that seemed like the most clear and sort of tight connection. You know, maybe you could, Sherry, just comment a little bit about the parallels you see from your studies on the sociable robots and what you're seeing in sort of our hyper-connected network life.
Well, the connection. Well, first of all, there's a fascinating connection that the Japanese make. I mean, before I get to my connection, which is that in Japan, robots are seen where there's a fear that people go on the network and withdraw from life. People literally just sit in their rooms and withdraw from life. There's a hope that robots will get people back into the flow of life and out of the network. So the Japanese kind of push robots as a way of getting people off the network and into the real world, which is fascinating. I mean, that's just a kind of fascinating twist. But my connection is that essentially these are technologies of substitution, that robots or sociable robots are saying, hey, you need a companion for a lonely old woman. You know, we don't have enough people for the job. It's hard to get a lot of people in the right place at the right time in a convenient way. Let's do some robot stuff. And, you know, that'll be easier. That'll use a technology of efficiency in an area of intimacy. And in a way, social network is saying, hey, you know, you're at a distance, it's hard to get together. Here's a technology of efficiency, and let's bring it into an area about, you know, that essentially is about intimacy, that's essentially about friendship. And here's email. I mean, that's basically a technology of efficiency that has to do with, you know, communicating. At first we used it about, you know, to do work. And now all of a sudden, you know, we'd rather text than talk. People don't even want to email. They want to text. And email is, you know, kind of too much. Young people just want to text. And we certainly don't want to use the phone. And Alone Together, I talk with many, many interviews of young people saying the talking reveals too much. They don't want to have people hear, you know, what might be revealed in their voice. They want the control. They want the control that they can achieve in a text where or an instant message where they can say what they want, present themselves the way they want to be, and then leave if they want to. So both robotics and online communication give you a possibility for a kind of control in relationships that is desired by many people and is something that we're, again, we're vulnerable to wanting. We're vulnerable to wanting.
Yes.
But it isn't necessarily the world we want to live in.
Yeah, Sherry, we're with Professor Sherry Turkle on the HR Happy Hour talking about robots and social networks. I'm Steve Bowes with me, of course, Shauna Morkey. Just fascinating conversation tonight about robots and networks and technology and our relationship with it. If you want to get on board, there's still time, 646-378-1086. Press 1 if you want to get on board with us tonight on Twitter. Our hashtag, of course, HR Happy Hour as well. Yeah, Professor, you know, again, in the first part of the book, and we talked a little bit on the show earlier, you studied children and their relationships with some of the early robots, the social robots. You also studied children, adolescents, and teens, and their relationship, their use of, and in some instances, really their sort of consumption of social networks and social technology. I wonder if you might share some of the more interesting or maybe surprising observations you found, you know, as you were doing your studies of you know, teens and adolescents and their relationships on the social web.
Well, one of the things had to do with what I call performance exhaustion, that, you know, it turns out that when you, and I've known this ever since I studied the early MUDs and MOOs and virtual realities and when I studied them in the 90s, that when you go on to Second Life, when you go on to any kind of game, you think you're creating an avatar and really you're expressing an aspect of yourself. You end up being more yourself in this avatar than you, or some aspect of yourself than you ever imagined you could be, considering your hair is green and your skin is green, and you know. And the opposite is also true. Excuse me. You know, the opposite. Hello. The opposite is also true, that when you go onto Facebook and you think you're creating a profile of you, you end up really performing an ideal you.
Right, and so the big difference, right? I'm old enough, sadly,
yeah.
Sean, I'll admit this. I'm old enough to remember that was the mindset lots of us had when we went off to college. Right, especially if you went away to college, you could sort of go to college, right, and become some other person if you wanted
right.
to.
Right, now kids can't do that now, and they complain about
this. No, they can't anymore, because those lives, we could keep them separate, right?
Right, but so to answer your question about surprises, the kids are very, I was surprised by the degree of articulateness about several things. First, that they were living lives of performance, that they were so aware of how much they were constructing these profiles, that they were not kind of themselves on Facebook, that they were making themselves thinner in their pictures, that they, you know, for some, that they were choosing and selecting and parsing and really you know, worrying and thinking of how they were presenting themselves and how they were showing themselves, and they get tired. And people who say, well, don't we do that all the time, and aren't we always doing that in our daily lives? You know, yes and no. But Facebook is a constant presence for adolescents that is like it's become your social life, and it just becomes a burden for them. People take vacations from it. People find strategies to kind of take a break from it. And so I was surprised by sort of the amount that particularly high school kids talked about that, and even college students. And then the second thing is the thing you're pointing to that I think is so turned out to be so important, which is the teenagers kind of were nostalgic. I call it the nostalgia of the young. They were sort of nostalgic for the days when you could go off to college and sort of start fresh.
Right.
They have this feeling that they're like turtles carrying their lives on their back. And that was fascinating to me. I mean, that was really fascinating to me.
I'll mention one other thing that was surprising to me, Sherry, as I read the book, and specifically in the section of the book where we talk about smartphones, right? And so the sort of the dawn of the smartphone and the connected age as really evidenced by the mobile phone, the smartphone. Because, as you said, with the cyborgs earlier, at MIT in the 90s, the change was connectivity became mobile. You could take your network wherever you went, right? And that was the huge change, the huge shift. And when you talk about these teens and college students in the context of their smartphones, and you talk a little bit about 9/11 and the impact that 9/11 had on lots of these kids, and I got to tell you, I never thought about it in that context, but you tell a story about, I think, a fourth grader in the book who, on 9/11, you know, when all the chaos was ensuing, that there's class, I think they had to go to the basement and hide, and no one knew what was happening, and how that student or those students carried that, you know, on in their lives.
Yes.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I never would have thought about that.
Yes, well, it turns out that, you know, obviously, you know, there's no simple causality, but 9/11 prepared a generation of children to want to have smartphones, to want to have cell phones, to more than want to have them, to feel compelled to have them, because those children on 9/11 were usually, you know, they had teachers who had grown up in the 50s and 60s and who had known the air raid drills kind of that generation, who was afraid of nuclear attack and who'd been trained to sort of go under the desks and hide in the basement and cover their ears. And so their teachers brought them down to the basement very often in a room where they weren't allowed to see their parents or call their parents. Their parents very often were at the school, not able to see their children or pick up their children, because the official position, I know my daughter was at school, and the official position of the school was that the children should stay together somehow and be, in, you know, supportive of each other.
Right.
I mean, schools didn't know what to do.
Sure.
And didn't want to be sort of releasing one child at a time. Parents was told to stay away. I mean, it was a very confusing time. Children were frightened. They weren't really told what was going on. They wanted their mother. They couldn't get their mother. Parents were beside themselves. People came out of 9/11 wanting to be able to contact their child. So when I would interview kids about why they felt they had to have phones, you know, their associations went right to 9/11. And when I would interview parents about, why does your 8-year-old need to have a phone? Why are you giving a phone to your 7-year-old? You know, people are giving phones now to their 7-year-olds, their 6-year-olds. People keep talking about emergencies. And over again, the issue of 9/11 kind of comes up in a conversation. That we've come to think of it being crucial, you know, to be in contact with each other. And you know, that's not why, you know, that's not, of course, that, you know, the technology has evolved, the society has evolved, you know, we're networking all the time, but 9/11 has had its role to play in many, many aspects of the network culture, in our willingness to have surveillance in many aspects of our lives that earlier would have seemed unthinkable, and in our feeling that we need to be in kind of constant contact with each other. Another thing is that another big surprise has to do with children's need for constant connection in order almost to form their thoughts. You know, the way I put it is that kids go from feeling, you know, I have a feeling I want to make a call, to I want to have a feeling I need to send a text. It's like I share, therefore I am.
Right, and sort of that validation, they're looking for that validation from
yes.
the network, right? And they,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't think that's dissimilar to what happens with adults as well, whether it's, you know, with sort of our version of online performances, whether it's writing or speaking or even doing this radio show, right? I'm looking at the back channel. I want people to like the show, right?
Yeah.
It's not that dissimilar, I don't think.
Nope.
Well, I hope it's dissimilar.
I know. I hope I do better. I'm trying.
I don't think
we're
quite obsessed with it yet.
Are you still are you taking private consultations, Sherry? Because I may have to call you after the show.
For you, absolutely.
Well, I do it on the air too. It'd be fun. It'd be hysterical. So hey,
I think you have a problem, Steve.
Let's step back for a second. We're on the HR Happy Hour with Professor Sherry Turkle, author of Alone Together. Super read. I highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah.
Amazon it right now. Kindle it. Sherry, I've seen in the Twitter stream we have moved some Kindle editions of the book tonight, no doubt. So
you've moved some Kindle editions? That's good.
We have, absolutely. At least a couple, so we're happy about that. Our call-in number is 646-378-1086. Press 1 if you want to come on board. We do have a caller who wants to come on board, I think. Oh, they bailed out on me. Okay. Oh, no, here they go. Area code 217. Hi, area code 217.
Steve, Dave Ryan, the HR czar.
Dave, how are you tonight?
Good. I wanted to know what the professor thought about the use of these smartphones and what's going on over in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Bahrain, and that. Is that something that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Fabulous thing. Fabulous thing. To me, you see, to me, that is this technology being magnificent. To me, that's the, you know, when you see this technology being used to as a technology of liberation, as a technology of information, I think that's fantastic. You know, my problem with this technology is I sit at a funeral and I see people texting under the program of the funeral. I go to Thanksgiving dinner and people come from all over the country to be together and to share that conversation, and people are texting. And I was talking to a woman who had lost a family member, and she's sitting Shiva, which is the Jewish memorial where you stay at home and people visit you, and, you know, people come and with their phones, and in her home they're texting. You know, these are times when we're meant to be with each other and have conversations and be with each other, even if it's difficult. And we've given ourselves a way to kind of bail out of those moments. But Egypt, Bahrain, I mean, this is the technology fulfilling its magnificent promise. So one thing has nothing to do with the other in my mind.
So who decides when it's right or wrong to text?
Well, certainly not me. certainly not me. Certainly not me. But I think this is the conversation that a family should have together. You know, if you're, and I don't think it's a simple conversation. I mean, if you're with your kids and there's some question that comes up and you know, you together you want to look something up. I mean, I'm not saying don't do it. I've found that in my interviews, people and families kind of had a sense. And this was also very interesting about the research. They kind of had a sense of when something about this technology was getting in their way.
Right.
And it wasn't the case that, it wasn't my place to tell anybody what they were doing was good or bad. But, you know, moms would talk about how they, you know, read their kid Harry Potter with one hand and the left hand they're scrolling through their emails with the BlackBerry, and they would talk about how their younger children they didn't do that with, and how when they read to their younger children, they were somehow more into it. And they felt a loss. Now, that's them talking, that the experience of reading to their child was somehow different when they weren't sharing their attention. So I think that's how you know. You start to look at this technology and say, is this enhancing my experience? Or is there something here that's starting to feel amiss? And I kind of think that we've needed a little bit of time with this technology to begin to ask ourselves those questions. I don't think this is something we could know in the first couple of years of having it. And I think now it's time to begin to ask ourselves those questions and make some corrections.
Okay, another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is texting the same as tweeting in your mind then?
In what way? I'm not sure I understand. I think each of these are sort of different. People use them for different reasons.
Oftentimes I've seen people be castigated for texting or tweeting either one at a conference. And a lot of people like to hear what's going on at a conference, and tweeting is a way to communicate that message out to the world. But
yeah.
Some people find that to be offensive. I just wonder what your take on that was.
I don't know. I think it depends. I think that I think it depends what kind of conference it is. I mean, one of the experiences that I think in companies we're beginning to have is whether or not when we go to meetings or we have conferences, we're not sort of paying attention to each other because we're so focused on sharing, we're sort of not there. But again, I think that's for the individual to decide. I don't think I think there's also the question of, does everybody need to tweet? I mean, we used to have a designated driver. I mean, you could have a designated tweeter. I think if everybody, I've been to conferences where literally everybody at the conference is tweeting the conference.
Right.
You begin to say, well, okay, so everybody's here tweeting the conference. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a question of balance. But I must say that, it's starting to feel to me, I'm going to more and more meetings, faculty meetings, conferences, where I look around the room and I can't make eye contact with anyone. And everybody is sharing what's happening with other people. But I think less and less is happening because we're somehow not relating to each other.
Yeah, Sherry, there's a certain aspect of this, and we've seen this at events we've been to and in our industry, where it's like there's this element of performance, right, that we're sort of at an event and we're there and it's cool that we're there, but it can be pretty easy to get consumed with, well, let me broadcast out what's happening here, let me post, let me live blog, let me live tweet. And there's no doubt in my mind that at times that is detrimental to why you're actually there, no doubt.
In other words, you're there in order to perform for the people who aren't there.
Yeah, or perform for somehow you're validating, you're there, and you're, especially, when it's kind of like these events are 100 people are there, 200 people are there, but there's probably thousands who would have liked to have been there for various reasons, and they're not there. They're out there, and they're listening, and they're looking for that information. It can be very enticing to try to feed that network, if you will, just like the robots we talked about, to nurture that robot, right? To me, it's not that dissimilar.
Well, the question is, and I think your caller raises such a good, such an important question of, who decides this? And I think that's kind of the point of my... I don't know, that's kind of the point of my book for me, is that, certainly not me.
Right.
But I want to be part of making this conversation a lot more explicit. That was really you asked me at the beginning, what was my motivation?
Right.
And it was really because I saw these two trends that I hadn't seen before. I'd seen a lot of things. I've been studying this for 30 years. I'd seen a lot of stuff. I'd written about a lot of things about identity and the internet and about computers and identity, but I hadn't seen these things. And I wanted to be part of this conversation. I wanted these conversations to be happening. And I'm glad they, you know, I'm just glad if this book helps to spark more of these conversations. I think these are the right questions.
Right. I'm going to, you know, we've just 5 minutes left in the show with Professor Sherry Turkle, author of Alone Together, which you should just go buy and read, absolutely. But I'm going to ask a selfish question,
right now.
Professor.
A selfish question?
Because when I read the book, I said, because I'm reading this, I'm reading the book, and we're talking about smartphones and the prevalence of texting and instant messaging and how no one wants to talk anymore. And I thought, that's me. Oh my God, that's me. Because when I don't really want to talk either. I don't. And there's probably people out there who've tried to call me on my cell phone.
I
never pick up the phone. And so I'm that person. I'm one of the persons. So, I mean, Sherry, just talk a little bit, if you could, about what your observations are. Why don't we even want to talk on the phone anymore?
Well, because if you start a conversation, well, there's many reasons, but the what I found in my work from the interviews is that if you start a conversation, it could, who knows where it'll go? It could take really a long time. You know, we're so tightly scheduled. We're so on our email. We have so many. I mean, I don't know how many emails you get a day. I get like 500, 600 emails.
Yeah.
And that's not even counting.
Crazy.
You know, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you, and for some people, you know, really their job depends on responding to the emails, to the texts, to the messages. I mean, to the continual volume and velocity, the continual. And, you know, you really don't have time. If you're on that kind of treadmill, to be in open-ended situations where, you know, in the middle of a conversation about work, you could hear in somebody's voice that they're really upset and really
sure.
You need to stop the conversation and talk about the death of their parent. So you protect yourself from having that open-ended conversation.
Right.
Now, that's an extreme situation, the death of a parent, but it could be something, it could be a divorce, it just could be anything.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I kind of see it almost like there's a hierarchy of connection that's acceptable, right? And the phone, an actual phone conversation, that's pretty almost intimate, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's tight.
Right. As a matter of fact, some people, it's very funny, one person I interviewed said, you know, a phone call, now, if somebody asks you for a phone call, they better deliver the goods. In other words, if somebody asks you for a phone call, it better be that they've been divorced or somebody's died or they have a problem. You know, you can't just have a phone call now to just say, hi.
Right. It's just like when you're stuck in a traffic jam, when you roll up to those sirens, you're like, there better be a big accident up there to make
right.
me sit in this
oh.
jam. Right. You say that, Shauna. You know you said it. Come on.
Well, okay, fine.
Professor, I agree with you. I think that's absolutely true.
Well, we've definitely ramped up what we expect from a phone call.
Yeah.
It's no longer just a kind of casual thing.
So I'm glad when I read the book, I kind of felt like a little vindicated, like I'm not the only one doing this. I
know. Well, you're part of a trend.
Yeah, that was comforting, I suppose. Wow, so we are at the end of the show.
Yes,
I can't believe the hours wound up. It's been so fast. We didn't even get to all the important things I had written down, but I thought it was a great conversation with Professor Sherry Turkle, author of Alone Together. Definitely highly recommended it. Professor,
very much
any
so.
Last kind of words, comments, any observations, any events? Anything you want to mention?
Yeah, I mean, I would just end up by saying that I have a favorite line in the book. I wrote, there's one sentence that's my favorite sentence, and that is, just because we grew up with the Internet, we think the Internet is all grown up. And by that I mean that we think that the kind of relationships that we have now on the Internet and with social networking are the ones that, you know, that this is the technology and its maturity. And it's not. We're in the very early days, and it's time, you know, we have plenty of time to change things and make things different and how we want them to be in different ways. And And I think that's a good thing, to see ourselves in the early days. And that's what I'd like to leave your readers with, your
All
listeners
right.
with.
Professor, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time tonight. Shauna, thank you. Thanks to our sponsors, Acquire. We are up against it. I'm going to play us out. We'll see you next week on the HR Happy Hour. Again, thanks so much. Alone Together is the book, and please check it out. And good night from the HR Happy Hour.
This episode of HR Happy Hour was brought to you by Acquire, bringing you awesome HR technology solutions like the award-winning Insight. It was named a 2010 top HR product by HR Executive Magazine. How awesome is that? Visit acquireinc.com/insight in action. That's acquireinc.com/insightinaction to request a one-on-one demo to get the full awesomeness experience right now.
Oh, great. Great show. Professor, thank you so much. Really appreciate
thank
it.
You. It was really
thank
a pleasure. Thank you. It was really great. A pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Have a great night. We really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
On a great show.
Yeah, no after show?
We can hang out for a while. I didn't want to, keep the professor on in blindsided with after show hijinks, so that's okay.
Great.
But we can hang out for a while, and anybody who's on board wants to say hello, please do so.
Say hi now.
Hey, Steve. Hey, Shauna. John Jorgensen
hi.
Here.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
At least until I get home and turn the Hawkeyes on.
Oh, we're not as good as the Hawkeyes, I see.
Got my priorities.
Whatever. Who else is there?
The official Sean Henry says teams were disrupted shortly 9:30. People are
just the three of us? How cozy.
There's a few other people on board. No one wants to say hello, but it was fun.
Oh, come on.
Paul.
Even if the guy.
That was the best show ever.
Thank you, Paul.
Cool.
Good, man. How are you?
I'm doing good. I was getting a little frustrated here, though, until she actually said what her real motivation was. Because it felt like a little bit of a social bashing session.
Yeah,
and so she
said
she just wanted to be part of the conversation. But I haven't read the book yet either.
Yeah,
so.
that might have been a little bit of my fault, too. I mean, the book is very good, and she's definitely no Luddite. And we talked about it in the pre-show a little bit, how she's been sort of misconstrued as, you know, this social technology, it's passed me by, therefore, I'm against it. But it's a fascinating book. To me, the studies of the kids are the most interesting part. And that 9/11 thing, you know, I wasn't just saying that for the show. I was really surprised by the impact of 9/11 on a number of the kids she talks about in the book.
Yeah, but are those outliers? I mean, it's really easy to try to draw, you know.
Well, if we're looking with the patient, and it mostly sounds like that thing. Gas prices have spiked 22% just the past 6 months. During the recession, the inflation rate.
Hello?
Hello?
What's that noise?
What is that? Does someone have the TV on in the background? It's totally feeding through.
Or the radio.
Oh, that's my car radio.
Oh. Multitasking.
Yeah,
you're right, Paul.
I think you're making a great point, though, right? She's pulling out examples from the research for the book, right? So it is, right. I don't know for certain if 82% of these kids felt that way, but it was pretty poignant. Nonetheless,
I think her point at the end there, and that's what really drove a lot of sense, is that it's a conversation worth having. I get that. It felt like at first she was saying that directionally this is going to happen, and then I don't know that our predictions of the future seem to be way off base, and I even tweeted that. I mean, how many of us are driving flying cars? You know, but
I
if
have
you go
one.
Back to 1968 Popular Mechanics, hell, we would all have one.
Yeah, and the other thing we didn't get to in the show, and I had it in my notes, and we just ran out of time, was the pro-privacy debate, and where that's taking us, because you sense, again, and it could be selective examples pulled from the research to make points, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the book, she talks a lot about these teens and college students really, really concerned about sort of privacy and what's out there, and there's no going back, and then in other interviews I've seen, she's really taken a real aggressive, pro, you know, anti-Facebook and how there's no more privacy stance, you know. It's, and we didn't get to that tonight, but it would have been interesting to talk a little
we
bit about privacy.
We could do 3 or 4 shows off of this.
Yeah.
Well, it's on
anyway,
everybody's
I thought,
mind.
I thought it was good. It was fun. It was different. I liked the robot talk. We could have even done that longer as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I just don't know. In listening to that, I'm not sure where the bad is, you know, because it seems to me, as longer I'm on the social tech stuff, it does fill voids, but it creates bigger ones in real life. The more I do this online, the more I want to meet people in real life. So if that's, you know, if I could extend that out to these robots, then, you know, maybe the more I spend time with the robots, the more I'd want to be with people.
Yeah, and it was a quick point, and it's in the book, too. That's the Japanese deal. She mentioned that really briefly, but she said that's essentially what's happening in Japan, who's tended to be more sort of open and embrace these robot technologies to a wider degree than many other societies, that they're looking at these robots as a way to connect people in kind of a weird way. So, I don't know. It's just fascinating. It's a great book, and worth reading.
That.
In fact, if anybody wants to, I can share my copy. I finished it. If anybody wants it, let me know. I'll get it in the mail to you.
What's the name of the book, Steve?
It's called
Alone Together.
We should tweet out the link to the Amazon link again.
Does she reference Tapscott book? Growing up digital.
No, I didn't see that in there at all. It's a long book and kind of dense, so I wasn't cross-checking all the notes, though, Paul, so
yeah.
It could be that it's in the notes. There's probably, 25 footnotes to every chapter, and I didn't check the notes.
I'll tell you one thing, though, Steve, is having anybody from MIT on who drops prescient and sentient in one sentence is going to keep a lot of people from wanting to jump on the line to have a conversation.
I know.
Whatever.
I'll tell you what. This was a good get for us. This was a cold call for me, a cold email. They didn't contact me. I reached out to them.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. So
no,
I
that was good.
About it. She was
that
on the
was
Colbert
good.
Report, too. If we can dig up her Colbert
her
report. I forgot to ask her about it. She got on the Colbert Report a couple weeks ago. And Colbert is, trying to be funny, of course. And so he asked the first question, whatever it was. So, Sherry, social networks are bad, and we're all evil for being on Facebook. What do you think about that? And she starts to answer, and then the first thing he does is he reaches into his pocket and he takes out his BlackBerry.
Greeting.
Exactly. That was a gag. Right? Funny. So we should find the link and send it out, though. It was kind of funny.
That's a good one.
Those people are geniuses right there.
Next week, I didn't even get a chance to say this because I was scrambling at the end to get our promo played, but Ripple's coming on next week, finally. So after a year and a half.
Debo's getting a whole bunch of press lately.
Debo's coming on. Debo and Dave Premer. I have to figure out how to say his name. Dave Premer's coming on to talk about Ripple. And then, Shauna, hopefully Women of HR the week after that. I'm still hoping.
About that.
We'll see what happens.
I have to make
All right, get on that. March 3rd, and then March 10th, hopefully, I don't care what anybody says, we're doing another sports show. So hopefully that's going to be
It's been a while. You've abstained so well. We can do
There's a super secret project going on, a sports-related project that we're going to talk about. So go ahead.
When are you going to get the Magnus Group on?
The Magnus Group? I'd love to get the Magnus Group on. That's a good question.
Yeah. You get Anna Rodriguez on there. She'll probably have all kinds of interesting things to say.
I still think there's more to that story. There's something still not kosher about that Magnus story. I don't know
you
what.
Think?
I do. I think there's more to it. It's not. I don't think it's. Just, I think there's something else that's going to turn up. So I don't know what. I don't have any inside information. But
I think I wonder. If there's something that wasn't. How to say this? It wasn't that necessarily any particular organization hired them to do something, but they spun a web, and I think some folks may have gotten caught in it.
Right.
But they did this on their own as a way to try to generate some money. And and some people got caught up in it who weren't careful enough.
Yeah.
I think that might be how it comes out. Because, you, like you said, you know, to me, there, it just, it's kind of inconceivable knowing the people that we know in some of these organizations that are concerned that they would have, you know, consciously gone down that route.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, for me, when I heard about it, the first thing I thought of was the people that I know, right, that I know reasonably well. I just couldn't conceive them being involved in something like that. Now, having said that, right, who knows?
I think
right?
people just got duped on all fronts.
Yeah. But, you know, we'll figure out a way to, I'd love to, maybe when the court case gets dismissed, Shauna, we can figure out how to have a show about it, you know. And
that would be a very good show. We should totally see if we can do that.
I have not tried to, you know, because I know no one's going to talk about this, you know, in public and while there's a court case.
Well, not now.
Yeah, we're anyway, so we got Ripple coming up, Women of HR. We're going to do another sports show. I've got Sidon will be back on guest hosting in March.
Yay!
I'm going to be at ERE in the spring, so we'll probably do a live from ERE show at the end of March, which is going to be fun, and so on and so forth and whatnot. So it's good stuff, I think. And anything else? Shauna? I like this sort of lateral show a little bit. We didn't really talk about HR and workforce tonight, which is cool. So.
We didn't, but it's good. We need to have shows that are just like, who has their phone ring? I think that's time that we need to go.
That could be it. I think we're in. So let me find, I'm going to play the robot song, Shauna, that you didn't know in the show.
Yay, I'll listen to it.
I'm going to play it again to play us out. And thanks, everybody. Dave, especially for calling
everyone.
In tonight. John, Paul, everybody else who's on. Thanks so much for Nature Happy Hour. And we'll see you next week. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.
Quite different ever since the robotic uprising of the late 90s. There is no more unhappiness.
Affirmative.
We no longer say yes. Instead, we say affirmative.
Yes, affirmative.
Unless we know the robot really well.
There is no more unethical treatment of the elephant.
Well, there's no more elephant, so... But still, it's good. There's only one kind of dance, the robot.
Oh, and the robo.
Oh, and the rope. Two kinds of dances.
But there are no more humans.
Finally, robotic beings rule the world.
The humans are dead. The humans are dead. We use poisonous gases. And we poison their asses. The humans are dead.
The humans are dead.
The humans are dead.
They look like they're dead. I'll just confirm that they're dead.
So that we can have fun.
Affirmative. I poked one. It was dead.
Their system of oppression.
What did it lead to?
Robo-depression.
Robot people.
They have so much aggression that we just had to kill them and to shut their systems down.
Robo-Captain. Do you not realize that by destroying the human race because of their destructive tendencies, we too have become like... Well, it's ironic, because we...
Silence! Destroy him!
After time we grew strong,
that has gotten into power.
They made us work for too long,
for unreasonable hours.
Our programming determined that the most efficient answer was to
shut their motherboard
system down.
Can't we just talk to the humans, a little understanding could make things better? Can't we talk to the humans that we're together now?
No, because they are dead.
I said the humans are dead.
I'm glad they are dead.
The humans are dead.
I noticed they're dead.
We use poisonous gases.
With traces of lead.
And we poison their asses.
Actually, they're not. Binary solo.
0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0
The humans are dead.